we're starting, as the syllabus says, we're starting symmetric hyperbolic systems. I wanted to start with linear symmetric hyperbolic systems. But first I wanted to start with a vote, which is the Fields Institute has a variety of activities, including workshops. And there were two in the fall. There are going to be at least four in the spring. And this room is full of people, and there's a lot of activity. And what I wanted to ask is, should we have class during those periods? And I'll tell you what my vote is. Let's see, how many? I think there are about 10 really, truly enrolled students here, 10 or 11. I'm not sure if postdocs have a vote. Yeah, everyone has a vote. But I have, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. I have 15 votes, too. Just joking. So the vote is, should we nonetheless meet next week, despite the fact that there's a workshop going on? And we would meet at the same time, for the same period, we just talk in the library. The only difference is, I don't have to wear a microphone, and I have to erase the blackboard more often. And the option is not go through that material. And it is an option, and people who are tired of teaching often take that option, but I'll tell you, I was going to canvas for, let's meet anyway. I think it's important that we carry on making progress. We've had a small enough time, somehow the year has evaporated. So that's what I'd like to do. So, but it's up to you. So who votes for, we don't cancel class, I guess we suspend the class, postpone class, until after, postpone next week's class meeting. The trouble is, the same is going to happen the week after, and the week after that. And then in May, it will happen two times, if not four times. So I vote actually that, well, it's just a talk or two of the conference we have to miss, and we'll have our class meeting in the library upstairs. Shall we vote? I vote for, let's meet our class next week. Okay. I'm highly influencing the vote, and it's not a secret ballot. Who doesn't want to meet next week? Not so many people. Good, let's do that. I think it's better. I mean, I also encourage you to go to the talks of the workshop, but as it is, you can't go to everything. So the people who are sitting in have to make a difficult choice. Well, the students have to make a difficult choice. I encourage you to at least go to something. Not take the occasion to pretend you're there when you're here, pretend you're here when you're there, and go do something else, and hang around in the coffee shops. Okay, let's start with linear symmetric hyperbolic systems, which, according to my note, my numbering scheme is section 4.7. So this is this stems from a paper in the Communications Pure Applied Math in the 1950s by Kurt Otto Friedrichs. And it's an important class of equations, actually both linear and nonlinear. I'll talk about both. and of course, the first section is on the linear case. And it's not that every single equation fits into this mold, but most of the important equations of mathematical physics and enter in this category. And so there's something, in fact, general that you can say about them, which has to do with, if it's a linear equation, with an existence theory, and if it's a nonlinear equation, with at least a local existence theory. It gives the basic facts. In some sense, this is to be treated as the elementary theory upon which all other things are built. What sort of equations? I'm going to describe them later, but things like Maxwell's equations. fits in linear theory, or equations for or the wave equation is a linear symmetric hyperbolic system. A wave equation on a Riemannian manifold is the same, a symmetric hyperbolic system. Nonlinear systems include compressible Euler equations or Einstein's equations for general relativity, well, in the appropriate coordinates. So it's an important class, you can see. So let's get going on this. What's the setting? So let's take x in n dimensions, little n dimensions. Time is real. Time sometimes will be called x naught. I'm going to look on all the line. And then I'm going to look for functions, and they're going to be it's going to be systems, so it's vector functions. U, that is a function of x and t, and u itself I want to be it's a system of equations, so it's going to be an Rn. Capital N bigger than little n. Capital N different than little n, sorry. Not necessarily bigger or smaller. And then they have particular form. So this is my equation 1 of the day. We'll be constantly referring to it. A coefficient matrix, A0, which depends on x, can depend on x, t, and u, partial t of u, plus other coefficient matrix, aj, which can depend on x and t and u, partial xj of u, and then we sum over the spatial variables, j equals 1 to little m. I could have put this in there using x naught, but I'm choosing to distinguish it. But now there's no places where u appears completely undifferentiated, so then there's a vector function itself, would be, which depends on x and t, and also possibly on u, and I want that to be equal to 0. I'm distinguishing t and a naught, so partly because I want to study the initial value problem, and I'm going to set the hyperplane t equals 0 to be my Cauchy surface. So I want to pose that u starts out, so u is a function of x, but when t is equal to 0, I'm going to give initial data f. And remember, u is an n vector, so f for each x is an n vector. And I'm not specifying, it probably should sit in some function space, I'm not specifying which at the moment. And we're going to work out which one we need to proceed. They just depend on u itself. So in some sense, in our previous views of single first order theory, it's a first order, but it's not a first order equation, it's a first order system. And we said this is a quasi-linear system, because the coefficients can depend on u, but the highest derivative, that is the first derivative, enter linearly. So it's a quasi-linear system. Now, in preparing the lecture, I had to decide, am I going to give the examples first or am I going to give the examples later? And I decided to give the examples later, so I hope that's okay with you. Let's just take it for the moment that these class of problems are interesting. So I have to tell you what the A's are, because they're not completely arbitrary. So the N by N matrices of coefficients of the problem, I want them to obey several hypotheses. Well, let's make that two, and let's see, first off, let's just have them all smooth. So A is a function of x, t, and now v. So that says x is an Rn, r little n, t is a real number, and v is a n vector, so I just want this to vary over n components. As a function of n components, I want this to be smooth. Let's just make it C infinity so we don't worry about counting. Like V1 quantity squared. Okay, that's hypothesis one. Oh, A naught and AJ. So let's make A naught and AJ and V in C infinity of the appropriate place. These are n by n matrices. I confess this is an n vector. quite end by end matrix. Hypothesis two is a little bit more content. This is just that's just setting it up. The symmetry of the label is the fact I want to insist upon that A naught transpose matrix is always equal to A naught, and AJ transpose matrix is always equal to AJ. That's the symmetry. And the hyperbolicity, so the hyperbolicity, maybe I'll call this a positive, how do I want to say it? Well, hyperbolicity has to do with symmetry too, so I'm just going to call this positive. I also have a positivity condition on A naught alone. I want A naught of XTV, maybe for all XTV, or at least all the XTs and Vs that we're considering. I mean, I might only look for solutions which sit in some neighborhood of V space. I want that to be a positive definite matrix. In fact, I'd rather say the following thing, that as a matrix, I have 1 upon C naught zeta squared less than or equal to zeta A naught with these arguments, XTV zeta, and that's bounded above by C naught zeta squared for all Z naught n. Well, this is an n by n matrix, so this is in this is in R capital N. And if we do that, then we have a general theory. So this is in general quasi-linear, but let's start with looking at linear, the linear case. Well, it's clearly A is then a function of XT, and AJ are functions of XT, but to all two. So I want to ask that 2, 1, 2, and 3 hold. That's basically the setting I want to be in. Okay, well, let's see. I also want to do the following thing. If it is linear, A depends on X and T, AJ depends on X and T, but B, I don't want to be just a function of X and T. So B is going to be of the following form, XT, a new matrix BXT on U, minus an inhomogeneous term, HXT. And that allows me to write the new equation, which is my equation 3 today, partial T, A naught partial T U plus sum over J, AJ partial XJ U plus B U. This and this and this all depend on X and T equals H. And then I'm going to give initial data U of X 0 is going to be equal to F of X. And that's the initial value problem I want to solve. Okay. Small amount of notation. I'm going to squeeze that in here too. And that is vector inner products. Well, we have to take two types of inner products. One is I have a function U, I have a function V, their inner product can in L2 is the integral over whatever domain you have, U times V. Or maybe U times V bar if they're complex. But also these are all vectors. So what I want to do is denote this bracket, the bracket notation, to be the finite dimensional version. So a vector U, a vector V, I want to be equal to sum JL is equal to 1 to capital N UJAJL VJ. VL, sorry. And symmetry is with respect to that inner product. But if these are functions, say, of X and T, then so is this. And I haven't yet taken any inner product as over function spaces. So I just bracket notation is the finite dimensional, and then integrals are going to be the infinite dimensional component of taking inner products. Okay, let's start doing a little bit of calculus. So proposition one. And actually, that in our numbering scheme, which I think I now have right, this is 4.27. Sorry the number is getting so big, but it's a long section. And what do I have? I have, as long as we have A, X, T in once differentiable, and I need it, what does it have? It has X in Rn, T in R, and it's a n by n matrix. So that's a set of n by n matrices. And if this is symmetric, of course, I mean with respect to this sense of inner product, then for any smooth vector function u of x, we could do the following thing. Partial xj, oh, and also for all j is equal to 0, 1, up to n. It's a Leibniz rule thing. Partial xj of the inner product u, au, is equal to two things. One, well, it's equal to three things. The derivative can hit this vector, or this vector. But by symmetry, if it hits the first and last factor, that's the same. So I got 2 u, a partial t u, plus 1 times u partial t of a, multiplying u. And it's very simple, but the basic energy identity stems from this. So let's see what I want to do. Yes? Right. I was thinking doing t and doing xj separately, but then I set j equal to 0 as the t case. So now I've done them all in just one line. Sorry about that. So let's see. The basic energy identity stems from this. And let's do the following thing. Take equation 3. It's a vector multiply a matrix. The result is a vector. Let's take the bracket inner product of that vector with u, and then rewrite everything. As long as we have a C1 functions, let's do that and rewrite everything. So I take a bracket, and I find u a0 dtu plus sum over j equals 1 to n, u, a j, dxj of u, grant, I found a small error in my notes. Plus u matrix bu equals inner product u and h. And now, in n plus 1 places, I want to use this piece of the Leibniz rule, in particular, here and here. So I can rewrite this as being, and this is going to be my equation 4. It's important enough to refer to it. Partial t of u a naught u plus sum j equals 1 to n partial xj of u aju. Now, what I've done is I've taken this, which is that, and written it as though it has this piece minus this piece. So let's see if I get that right. So it's going to be Sorry, let me do it the other way around. I've just written down this with t plus these plus the xj's, and I want to write out what that gives us. So one thing it gives us is all of these terms. So it's going to give us an inner product of u. And my signs are wrong. That. It gives me a u partial t of a naught plus sum j equals 1 to n partial xj of aj, because the Leibniz rule gives me clearly these terms. But then it gives me twice times all of these terms. But twice times all of these terms is minus twice b minus twice h. So I get minus twice b u, and this is equal to twice u h. And this is a little wrong in my notes. Do I have that right? Let's see. If I take all these derivatives, I get twice the equation plus these terms. So I take all these derivatives. Oh, and I get, I get minus this. So let's make this, minus that. And I guess that gives me a, no, because it's minus the equation. Oh, minus b, the plus there. Very good. Thank you. Oof, thanks very much. Hard to think on one's feet. And there's some screwy signs in my notes, so that's giving me trouble. Okay, and now let's, this is a little awkward, so I want to call this term, C. It's a function of x and t. That matrix, n by n matrix. Okay, and now let's do the following thing. Let R be some subset of space-time. Let's make it a domain, which means that it's an open set with reasonably regular boundary, so that in particular the divergence theorem holds. And then let me use the divergence theorem. So that goes as follows. Integral over R, and I'm making two because I'm pretending one is space and one is time, although it's a little bit invariant with regard to that. And I'm integrating identity 4 over that region. So I have a big parenthesis, partial t, u a naught u plus sum of j equals 1 to n partial x j of u a j u. Let me close parentheses, dx dt, but I have other terms left, so I have plus double integral over r of u c x du dx dt, and that's going to be equal to double integral over r twice u h dx dt. These signs are a little annoying. So what I should have written here, plus, and this is a plus 2b, and it's a minus this, and it's a minus this, and it's a plus that, and that's what I want to call c. And if I do that, then that's c. And then, of course, what I need to do is apply the divergence theorem. So So that in fact, the right-hand side is equal to. So this is equal to that, but the whole thing, of course, is still equal to the integral over the boundary of R of the following quantities: u, a naught u, plus sum j equals 1. Sorry, a little premature. a naught nu naught. So I'm still struggling to get this written down in the right order. On the boundary of R, the exterior normal derivative, the exterior normal vector, boy, I'm having trouble getting going this morning, nu has the time component, nu naught, and then the space components, nu 1 up to nu n. And then I write this, a naught nu naught plus sum j equals 1 to n, a j nu j, parenthesis around this u, that's the result of the divergence theorem on this term, d surface over R, but it's still plus the double integral over R itself of u cu. And that, according to this, is still equal to 2uh. And this is important enough to write down as a theorem. Which is R a domain with exterior normal nu. Then this holds. And the whole gimmick is now going to be is to choose domains in different ways to do different things. So we're going to do the following with our domains. We're going to first prove a uniqueness theorem. And for that, I'm going to choose domains which are in a which are just a slab. So I'll call R of T. So let me say this. Here's all of Rn, and here's time R, and here's T, and here's 0, and here's my domain. And I'm going to choose that one to prove uniqueness. And then I'm going to choose that one again. I'll call this R of T, because it's somehow, in some sense, the domain up to T. And then I'm going to choose it again and prove an existence theory. An existence theorem for you. And then I'm going to prove the weak Huygens principle, that is, for these systems, that is, the question of finite propagation speed, by studying domains T and R, N, that look like this. Lens-like domains. Maybe I shouldn't have exaggerated this quite so much. And what I'm going to ask over those lens-like domains, that of course, here's R, and here's the normal nu, the following matrix is an important matrix with regard to this problem. A naught nu naught plus sum over j, a j nu j, and let's see what I need. I need something. Well, this is a matrix. This is a matrix, and I guess what I need is I need the domain R to be chosen so that its normal nu satisfies this as being positive definite on top and negative definite on the bottom. In fact, I've made the bottom exactly part of the hyperplane t equals 0. We can choose any lens-like thing, but I've made the bottom part of the hyperplane t equals 0, so the exterior normal is just all these nu j's are just zeros, and nu naught is minus 1, so a naught times minus 1, a naught was chosen to be positive definite, so it's automatically negative definite. So this is already satisfied for what I've drawn, but it can be more general. But I need the top to be positive definite. That can fail if it gets too high. So what it's saying is there's, so to speak, a light cone that is supposed to lie above it. And as long as this stays space, like a space, like this is the definition of something which a surface is space-like. So as long as that boundary component, that boundary hypersurface is space-like, that's what we'll use in order to prove finite propagation speed. But I'm getting a little ahead of myself, so let's go to the uniqueness theorem. So so that says, what is our R? Well, of course, it's as I pictured. You take all xt with x and rn, and 0 less than t less than some capital T. In some sense, capital T is arbitrary. We're just going up to time 1, or time 1 century, or time 1 millisecond. It'll do the same, it'll theoretically at least serve the same purpose. Okay, and what I want to do, let's assume, so we're going to prove uniqueness among a certain class. And that's going to be good, a good class, once we come back and prove finite propagation speed. But for the moment, I have to have your suspended disbelief to say that this is a good class. I want to assume that U is a classical solution. Classical means it has one derivative and it's continuous. So I take the differential equation, which is up here, and I get a continuous function. U is a classical solution which goes to zero, so it decays as x goes to infinity sufficiently rapidly. When we go to prove finite propagation speed, the point is you can actually decompose your data into compact supported data. So it's zero at infinity. So the sufficiently rapidly is even moot. But for the moment, all I needed is sufficiently rapidly. Okay? And then let's integrate our identity. This is our identity for, might as well make it 5. Integrate our identity 5, or take 5, which already is an integral, over this RT. And we get the following expression. Integral over RN. Well, let's see. Let's see what happens on the top boundary. Well, it seems to me up here also, nu has the following form. The 0 component is plus 1, all the others are 0. Isn't that what the normal looks like? And so this boundary component is really u a naught u dx. And just to denote at what time we're evaluating this, I'll say I'm going to put this the coordinates, the space-time coordinates in somewhere. That's the top component of the boundary term. The side component of the components of the boundary term, well, those point outwards at infinity. Well, you find them by taking a limit, but u decays sufficiently rapidly there, so there's no contribution. But the bottom coefficient has nu being like that. So you subtract integral over Rn, u a naught when t equals 0, u dx. And that is equal to, that plus u c u plus double integral. Sorry, and I'm doing this a little bit wrong. This is a single integral because it's only under the space, over space, and doesn't not over time. And I'm doing this consistently here. One integral is a little bit fewer dimensions than a double integral, so this is over R. So this integral is a double integral, and it's over our region RT of U C U dx dt, and that's equal to the integral over RT of twice U H dx dt. And now the quantity, there's a quantity which is often in its physical setting related to the energy. So the energy E of U is the following thing for a general symmetric hyperbolic system. It's integral over Rn U A naught of xt U dx. And now, it's true, probably should be half that given physical setting, but forgive me, a half. And they're just coefficients, A naught, really. And it plays a prominent role in the analysis. And we assumed that A naught, what did we assume about A naught? It was a positive definite matrix. So 1 upon C naught zeta squared, it was less than or equal to A naught zeta, A naught zeta, less than or equal to C naught zeta squared. So that in particular, if I put in U, 1 upon C naught U of xt squared is less than or equal to U A naught for any t U is less than or equal to C naught mod U squared. And I integrate this dx if dx and this dx, and this is pretty clearly the L2 norm squared of U over Rn. And so is this. And so we conclude that E, well, it's square root. What I'll say is that E is like the square of a norm, certainly homogeneous degree 2 in U. And this upper and lower bound says it's not the same, but it's an equivalent norm. It defines the same topology in L2 as the L2 norm. The E of U, well, let me say square root of EU is an equivalent norm to L2. And so, in fact, we're going to start measuring vector functions in E norm rather than L2 norm. And it's just, in some sense, convenience. It fits well with the equation, and it's a change of constant at every stage. So, let's do the following thing. Let's look at this and inspect the various terms. So term one, which is term little one, which is integral over Rn U A naught of X T U dx. Well, that's and of course, actually, the individual constants comprising the energy norm change with time. I didn't mention that, but that's certainly worth mentioning. Energy norm has t the changes in t. It's still very well adapted to the equation. It changes in t, but it changes in t in a way that for each fixed t, it has a norm which is equivalent to the L2 norm. And so what I want to do is say this: if I do it at zero and I study u at zero, that's really the energy norm of the initial data squared, because u at x0 is equal to f. So square the energy norm at zero. We can study Rn u of xt a naught of x t u of x t dx. That's, of course, the energy of u at, what I'll say, at time t. Thirdly, that's another thing that occurs when t is capital T. So that's the first term, in order, the second term, the first term. Now I want to do the C. Let's look how big the term with C can be. So it's, let's not do the time integral yet. Let's just do the space integral. U, cu, dx. And now, C is a little complicated, but in any case, it's made out of the matrix B, and the first derivative of the matrices A. We assume those were all C1, so the first derivatives are continuous, bounded, so to speak. So there's a constant. I'll call it maybe C1. So that this is that, so that these constants are bounded by U. So that says that I can put in here R, and then U against U is really U squared dx. So that's the L2 norm of U. But of course, I don't want to measure things in L2 norm, and rather measure things in the energy norm. So modulo another constant, C1, C0, this can be given in terms of U, A0, U. And that A0 is adapted for the time at hand, x, t, u, dx. And so that's the third term. Then there's the fourth term, which involves the size of u h dx. And of course, it's the same thing. In fact, I'll make it even the size of 2 u h, because I have that 2 floating around. Well, I can rewrite this as being 1 half the integral over Rn u squared. Sorry, uh is bounded above by half u squared plus half h squared. The halves cancel by the 2. So un u squared dx plus integral of Rn h squared dx, which again is bounded, if I add a C naught, by the energy of U and the energy of F, just by the equivalence of norms. And let's see what we have when we put it all together. So this identity is the following, gives rise to a following differential inequality. So it gives a differential inequality. Which goes as follows. It says the energy norm at time H is the inhomogeneous term, and this is only the x integral. These all depend on t. These depend on t. And I want to take one thing back. I integrated over the entire domain, but let's do it a piece at a time. So let's move t, 0 less than t, less than capital T, and the only thing changes is this t, and this, I guess this one too. And what I wanted to do, I did that because I wanted to move it. So now I'm going to move it. So I'm going to use that identity, and I was about to write it here. So now I can write it for any t between 0 and capital T. 0 less than t, less than capital T. This is the energy norm of u at time t. It's equal to, what our claim is less than or equal to, and I'm going to put this term on the right-hand side, u a not u. That's the energy norm of F. Squared, I guess I should say. plus two things. This thing, the time, which is a time integral, that has a time integral in it. But for each of those times, it's bounded by the energy norm of U. So it's a constant I'll call C2, the time integral, the energy norm of U of S ds. Well, the constant is time independent because these are bounded coefficients. One derivative gives me a continuous and a bounded function. This is an identity, it's equality. So I'm going to take this to the right-hand side, that's this. I'm going to take u, cu to the right-hand side and bound it above in absolute value by this. But this is for every time, and that's a time integral, so I have to integrate. And I have one more term, which is 2uh, which I bound by this. So in fact, I get c2 plus 1 from the u squared part, from the EU part, and I get an energy of F, so plus integral from 0 to T, energy of F, energy of H, that's what I mean. Somebody asked me about that, and I didn't get it right. Integral from 0 to T, the energy of H at S, ds, for this part. So let's just check. I have that term is this. That term is this. This term is a time integral, it's this. This term is also a time integral, it's this. And this, I didn't lose anything by writing this down as exactly that term, but I bounded the others above. And the only thing that annoys me about this is the C2 plus 1, so I'm going to redefine C2. That's what I want to be C2. So to speak, I've just set C2 to be something that looks like C0 C1 plus 1, just to make it look nice. Well, this is an inequality. I'm going to call this term H. It's some H of T. And then otherwise, this has an E of U at T, E of U at 0, and an integral of E of U. So that brings to mind what inequality? The Grönwall inequality. So let's apply the Grönwall inequality. So an application of the Grönwall inequality. So that's lemma. It should be proved, right? Lemma 4.29, which is Grönwall. The Grönwall inequality has many versions. So I guess I'm going to give you one convenient for the present setting. So let's let E some function of T. It's of course going to be that E, but let's just divorce itself and say E is some function of T, satisfy and be a positive quantity, a non-negative quantity, which satisfies an inequality of the following form. E at 0 plus a constant integral up to T, E of S ds, plus some other H of T. And let's, for convenience, define I of T to be integral of E. Integral from 0 to T, E of S ds. Then we can say something about how big I is and how big E is. So the first thing is I of T doesn't get any bigger than E of naught times a growing factor, but with bounded growth, E to the T E to the TC. C is the same C. But, of course, H can influence things, too. The influence of H is put in the following term, integral from 0 to t, e to the c, t minus s, hs ds. But often we want to know not about I, but about E. Well, you can see that this is E, but this is I, but this is H. So if you just plug this back in, you say that you see that E of T can't get too much worse than E to the C T E of 0. No, it can't get worse. It could be better, but it can't get worse. Plus something to do with H. There's an initial H of T, and there's an integral from 0 to T, E to the C T minus S, H of S ds. And every theorem should have a proof, so here's every lemma should have a proof, so here's a proof. Which is, here's the hypothesis. So let's do something about that. So I'm going to do the following. I'm going to write d by dt of the following quantity, I of t, e to the c t. Actually, I want e to the minus c t. And if I look at that, the derivative falls on the I and gives me e, and the derivative falls on the e to the minus c t, and it gives me minus c times this quantity. So this is equal to e of t, e to the minus ct plus plus I of t minus c I of t, e to the minus ct. And if I do this e of t minus c I of t, that says it's less than or equal to e of 0 e to the minus ct plus h of t e to the minus ct. Isn't that right? And now I integrate it. This is just rewriting what this says. And now I integrate this. It's a derivative, so that says I of t e to the minus ct minus I of 0, that's the integral of this between 0 and t. And that's less than or equal to e 0, now I have to integrate from 0 and t, e to the minus c s ds. That's from that term. So I integrate this, that gives me this side, now I'm integrating the right-hand side. This just gives me integral of an exponential, and this gives me integral from 0 to t, e to the minus cs, h of s, ds. And of course, now I should really rather multiply through by e to the ct to get rid of this slight annoyance factor. So I of t is less than or equal to plus e to the ct, and here I get e to the ct minus s, that's what happens here, and here I get e to the c t minus s ds. And now let's just check whether we prove what we want. I of t is less than or equal to, we did something wrong here. Oh yeah, I of t is less than or equal to I of 0 e to the ct. Very good, thank you. This was to be this plus that, plus e naught e to the ct minus s ds plus this integral. Well, what remains is to do this integral, which is, of course, e to the c t minus s over c between s is equal to 0 and t. With a minus sign, and which of course gives us e to the c t minus 1 over c, and we bound that by t e to the c t. And now we have this on the left-hand side and this, oops, wrong line. This on the left-hand side and this plus this on the right-hand side. Let's look at the inequality itself. E naught, what do I want to do? So we've proved 6. Let's prove 6. One more thing is we want to prove 7. But I guess if you you see what you lack from this, well, here you have ET is bounded to E naught plus something to do with the integral of E, but this is I, so plug in what I is, and you get something to do with E naught plus the integral of H plus H again. And then that's just a restatement of this. So in fact, we've also proved 7 by just plugging it into our original inequality. So we're now in place to finish our uniqueness theorem. And sorry I took so long on this, but I think we're just about ready. And that's theorem 430, which says solutions of linear symmetric hyperbolic systems are unique. Well, that is, given initial data that is 0 and H that is 0, then U that is 0, at least among solution classes which decay sufficiently rapidly at infinity. Again, I remind you we're going to prove finite propagation speed, so that will be the case for this data. And the proof is, use the Grönwall inequality over RT. And so we find in particular that IT, which is of course integral from 0 to capital T, E of S dS, is bounded above by T, E to the C naught T, because C naught is what we get when we apply, yes, that's what I should say, is that this is for some abstract E. I haven't said what its use is, but we look upstairs and see that this is precisely the differential inequality that we got out of the symmetric hyperbolic system. So that our I of T, which is the energy, let me say this, energy of U at S integrated from 0 to capital T, is bounded by T E to the C naught T, the energy of U at 0, which is the energy of F, plus integral from 0 to capital T, E to the C naught T minus S, and what was it? H of S dS? That's what this is. Also, little notational problem. Let me see. This is E and H. Yeah, I guess that's right. It doesn't even really matter. H of SDS. But when little h is 0 and f is 0, this is 0 and this is 0. So this has to be equal to 0. And of course, this is. And that's because a naught is positive definite. It gives us a norm. In fact, it gives us a norm. So let me say that. I of t is equivalent to the square, let me say it this way, the square root I of t is equivalent to the L2 norm of U over the domain RT. And so if it's 0, then U vanishes, at least vanishes as much as an L2 function can vanish. And so that's the uniqueness theorem. Next step, I'm going to have a pause right now, but next step we'll work on the existence theorem, also in some sense in the similar category of solutions. So this is just for preparation for next time, existence theory. Okay, let's have a break for a little while, and then very short break, and then we'll come back and prove existence. Okay, we're talking about existence theory. This is an example, so existence theory, it says it up there, but I put it up, so now, for laziness, I'll keep this down. This is an example of an energy method. There are a variety of energy methods. This is an example of one. Typical example for evolution problems. So, quote, energy method, which is based on L2 theory, and actually our existence theorem today is going to be, in some sense, simply the Riesz representation theorem. So just wait, it will show up and I'll even explain what the theorem is. So what's the energy? It's this function E of U, which gave, if I took its square root, gave a norm equivalent to L2 norm. Well, how about if I don't square it, don't take a square root, I'll say it's equivalent to the L2 norm squared of our vector functions U. And I'll be interested in Hilbert spaces that are kind of made out of this. So not only that, I'm going to be interested in representing linear functionals on Hilbert spaces, made a little bit out of our energy norm. So let's start by a theorem which actually is the codifies what I want out of Riesz's work. So this is theorem 4.31, I guess we are, which is basically the basic Riesz representation. It says the following. So let H be a Hilbert space. With norm, so then we have a vector, I'll call the vectors U or V, norm sub H, given by the inner product. That's what it means to be a vector space. That's what it means to be a Hilbert space. Plus completion. Plus linear space, plus completion, I guess. Given by the inner product. So what should I say? We have a U against a V. There'll be an inner product. We'll call that the H inner product. And given means that I guess I get my norm. Sorry about being redundant. I take U inner product, U itself. That gives me a norm squared. In addition, suppose by some means or other we have a linear functional. On H, meaning L of U, every element in U gives me a real, L gives me a real number, and it's linear. And suppose it's bounded, that is, it's continuous. So with LU, and that number can't get bigger than some constant times the norm of U. That's what it means to be bounded. That's what it means to be continuous. Riesz representation asserts that there's an element of the dual space. Being a Hilbert space, that's an element of the Hilbert space itself. So he says, then there exists a V. It's a V of L, and so to speak, in H, such that for tell you what, I'm going to change notation a little bit. There's a WL, so to speak, such that for all V in H, L V is really just V inner product with W in the H norm. So it says it's the basic statement that the dual space to the Hilbert space is the Hilbert space itself. Okay? And what we want to do, so my goal is, our goal, This is assertion of existence. It says W exists. I want that to be existence theory for a PDE. The goal is to use this, so use the existence of W to show existence of solutions of our symmetric of the PDE at hand. Well, in particular, of our symmetric hyperbolic system. So let's go, and I've organized it into a number of steps. So I think about six, and each one is elementary. And in fact, the whole proof is really elementary. Oh, I should take this usual poll. Who's seen this story before? A lot of people. Okay. Who's seen Riesz representation before? Lots of people. Who's seen existence theory for symmetric hyperbolic systems using a representation theorem before? A few less people, but still some people. Anyway, it's a clean and elementary and softish. Nonetheless, it's good to learn. So, step one. Well, I should write a symmetric hyperbolic system that I want to solve down. So this is linear symmetric hyperbolic system. So A naught partial T of U plus sum over J equals 1 to N AJ partial XJ of U plus B applied to U, I want to solve this as equal to H. And I'm allowed initial data UX naught is equal to F of X. And that's the situation I want to consider. So step one, I'm going to claim that it suffices to consider F equals 0 and H is the data. Sort of coordinatize all my data by H. And of course, this is a standard trick. So suppose I have a solution here which is called U. Well then, and the way you do it is, so the trick is to study U1 of X, which is equal to U of X minus F of X. And so U1 of XT is U of XT, simply minus F of X constant. And then U1 of X0 is equal to F minus F is equal to 0. But of course, what equation does U1 satisfy? So then U1 satisfies, well, let's see what happens when I plug this in here. D by dt kills F, so I get A naught d by dt. Let me see that U is equal to U1 plus F. Let me write it that way. U is equal to U1 plus F. You don't have to change your notes, but I'm just saying I plug in U, take d by dt of F, this gives me d by dt of U1. So that gives me the same term. Now this gives me sum J equals 1 to N, AJ d by dxj U1, plus AJ d by dx JF. So this term, I have to go and put it into H. Plus B U1 plus F. This term, I have to go put it into H. And this is going to be equal to H. So take these terms, put it in H, take these terms, put it into H, and you have an And what you have is a symmetric hyperbolic system with an H1. Let's just change to H. But in any case, you can, with that simple trick, you can always start with zero data and just have an inhomogeneous term. That's step one. Step two. I want to consider U of X T. And here I am happily considering L2 functions and they're taking their derivatives. And that's not so great if I'm really an analyst. So what I'm going to do is look at C1 functions and take a closure. So I'm going to let U be a C1 function over my space RT. And I want it to be X support compact. So I want compact X support. So that means for every T, I want the X, you know, to be compactly supported in X, but uniformly so. And I also want it to start with at 0, so that U of X 0 is equal to 0. I mean, that's going to be my, because of my step 1, I reduced to that. Excuse me. I have to keep my speed up. And then I want to define an energy norm. On C01. Well, the thing is, you don't define norms on such spaces because the norm is, the spaces are not going to be complete with respect to such norms. So technically, if you're a very special functional analyst, you say it's a pre-norm. I'm going to complete some space and make it a norm on a bigger space, but I'm going to start with this space. Yes. No. No. I'm going to start with data between bounded on a ball of radius r, say, but it also fits in if by the time t it's 10r. It still satisfies the hypothesis. I don't make any qualitative statement about its compact support. It's just they're all functions with their, each function there is some r such that. I can take a sequence of functions which have larger and larger and larger support. In fact, I need to. But each particular function, there is some R in which its support lies. And it can look like light cones. It can look like anything you want. You can paint La Joconde in a picture of its support. And I don't mind. Just as long as it's ultimately at infinity, zero. I need a dense subset. So what is the energy norm to be? Well, this is a vector function of x and t, and I want its energy norm, and I want it to square it, but I need time and space in place. So I'm going to do the following thing. Integral from 0 to t of the energy of u of x t, dt, where this energy is this energy. Where, because I'm adapting I'm adapting the norm to match the equation, which is the way it should be, I guess. U a naught u dx. And the statement is u in energy norm, this norm is equivalent to U in L2 of RT, of that slab, just by your boundedness and positive definiteness of A. And then what does the linear symmetric hyperbolic estimate say? It told us something. It said that let me erase so I have a little more room. The linear symmetric hyperbolic estimate said that I capital T, I'll take it all the way to the top. I capital T, that reminds me of a joke, actually. I capital T is less than T e to the C naught T, some number at least, times the initial energy plus, what was it, C2, integral from 0 to T, e to the C naught T minus little t, h of little t, dt, and I, capital T, was in fact U squared, this energy norm. And on the right hand side, there's E of 0, but that's 0 in our setting. And we have to worry a little bit more about this thing. So I just want to say, what is 0 to t? E to the C naught, capital T minus little t, h of t. Let me make sure what we know what h of t is. It's, forgot a little bit what h of t was. Oh, it's the energy of h of s. So it's h of little t, a naught of x little t, h of little t. And h is a function of x too, of course, x t. The integral over r n dx, then the dt afterwards. What I just put in parenthesis is what's called E of h of s. That's E of h of t. It's the energy norm squared. Well, it's the energy squared, but I'm making energy norm L2 spacetime. It's a little bit different. And among other things, we may estimate this is equal to the integral from 0 to t, e to the c naught t minus little t, h of little t, dt, and we may estimate this above by some constant, which maybe is C3, little h squared in L2, but with fiddling with another C naught or so, we can make this into an energy norm. In fact, maybe it's already an energy norm, and we just have to worry about constants to dominate that, but capital T is fixed. And so, just to rewrite this all, we're in a setting, remember, where E naught is 0. So this is out. And we only have this, so I have the right-hand side, the left-hand side. So I just want to rewrite for clarity that this says that U, the energy norm squared, is bounded by some constant, C3, say, H squared in energy norm. I want to write this again, but I want to come back here and change notation so I can write it very neatly, which is, this is a linear differential operator on U with first order terms and zeroth order terms equals H. So I want to write this as L U is equal to H, U at x 0 is equal to 0. So in particular, H is equal to L U. So what I want to say is that U squared in energy norm is bounded above by some constant times LU in energy norm squared, at least for any U in this space, C0, 1. And that's an estimate. Step 3. Everyone happy? Step 3. I want to introduce the adjoint operator to L on the space of functions over RT. So the adjoint operator. On RT. So let's do this. Let me see. L star of V. So I'm just going to write it down and I'm going to argue what it is. So I want it to be, so let me see how this goes. Let's think of this, that I take this, which is LU, and I multiply by v, a vector multiply by v, and then I iterate over RT. And then every time derivative and every space derivative, I iterate by parts to get an operator on V against U alone. So it's pretty clear what that should be. I want it to be equal to minus, from the iterations by parts, d by dt on the other side of A naught transpose V. Fortunately, A naught transpose is A naught. That's the symmetry. Minus sum j equals 1 to n partial A partial xj of ajv plus b. Well, b wasn't necessarily symmetric, so I have to use b transpose v. And if we just decide to do all those differentiations, this is equal to minus A naught dtv minus sum j equals 1 to n aj dxj v plus, well, this b transpose on v, but also due to the Leibniz rule, the derivative could have hit the coefficients. So it's b transpose, and we have to get rid of those. So it's b transpose minus partial t a naught minus sum j equals 1 to n partial xj aj, close, operating on v. And that's L transpose. There's a little blank space that I'm going to use for that. The coefficients do depend on t, can depend on t. Well, I moved, well, this is outside because I integrated by parts. Here, it's inside, but when I integrate by parts on v, I get a minus sign d by dt of a naught v. A naught transpose, mind you, but a naught is symmetric.
Yeah, but then you assume a
naught
right?
No. Okay, we need the side calculation. Integral, double integral, of v a naught dt u dx dt is equal to double integral. First I take a naught transpose, so a naught transpose v partial t u dx dt, and then I do one more operation as I integrate by parts. So I have a minus partial t a naught t v u dx dt. Unfortunately, plus boundary terms, but I dropped them in my formal calculation of an adjoint. And now I'm going to put them back in when I say something about what's the adjoint problem.
Well, my question is, you can see the linear system, not quasi-linear, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I could anyway. But never mind. We'll discuss it afterwards. Okay? The adjoint problem. I want to solve L star of V is equal to H, maybe H star, a different H. And I want to solve data on some Cauchy hypersurface. So that's V of X, but at capital T, not at zero, is equal to zero. That's the adjoint problem. And among other things, let's make a couple of observations. One is that the adjoint problem is not symmetric hyperbolic. Why not? Only for the trivial reason it has a minus, and I wanted this positive definite. So it's a symmetric hyperbolic going backwards in time. Well, going forward too, it doesn't really matter, but you can expect to start with final data and go backwards, and then that's really a symmetric, and then we even have the signing condition right. Okay? So the adjoint problem has data, which is zero, given at the final surface, and the problem itself has data given in the initial surface. If I go back here for my calculation, I see that when I did integrate by parts in time, let's see, if I did my integrations by parts in space, the solution is C1 of compact support. I never got any boundary contributions. But the time integration, when I integrate by parts, there are going to be two terms, one and R, one T is equal to capital T, the other one T is equal to zero. And those correspond to V, A naught, U. The one where T is equal to zero, U vanishes there, so it vanishes. The one when T is equal to capital T, I now insist that my V is vanished there, so that term also goes out from V. So that's my sufficient discussion of the adjoint problem. Okay, and now let's do the following thing. Let's let V be in a certain pre-Hilbert space again. So I want it to be once differentiable over the slab RT, and I want it to be compactly supported as usual. So how do I say this? So it's equal to the set of V in C1 over the RT, compact support, compact X support, and V at X at capital T is equal to zero. And I'll call that C1 sub T rather than C1 sub zero. Okay? And then for U in C1 zero and V in C1 T, we just copy that calculation down and we find that the integral over the slab, RT, from 0 to T, and over Rn, well, did that, 0 the slab of VLU dx dt is equal to the integral of the slab of RT L star VU dx dt. Okay. And we've also decided, at least decided to believe. We also decided to believe that minus L star is U of V is a symmetric hyperbolic. Oh, equals say minus H star is symmetric hyperbolic. Okay, everyone agrees with that so far. So it's just, you do a symmetric hyperbolic system with time reversed. So step 4, and I think there are only six steps, which is define, let's see, I had a perfectly nice inner product here, didn't I? I never stated it, but of course a norm begets an inner product. So I guess my inner product, which was going to be U, V, energy inner product, is going to be equal to integral over the slab. I'll make it VU. Looks nicer. V, A naught U, dx dt. So I want to define a new inner product. Suppose it's so-called pre-inner product. So I want to do that to be, now I want to V and W. But I don't want it to be E, I want it to be somehow the starred version from it. And so I'm going to say is, well, here's my E inner product. So I want this to be instead L star V, L star W, in E. And then I want to say, well, L star, sorry, minus L star V is equal to H star is symmetric hyperbolic. And we look through what do we know about symmetric hyperbolic systems, and we have this estimate, which is sitting right here. So UE is less than LU in E. So we have the following estimate. We know, therefore, we have V in E squared is less than or equal to, what's that, C3? L star. Well, maybe it's a three C3 star, so C4. It might be another constant because there are different coefficients in L star. L star V in E squared. That's what it says. U is less than C3LU. So V is less than C4L star V. And I want this, and so that's some, and now this inner product says that this is, so that constant times V squared, the E star inner product. And so one question is, I put in L, and then I said it was a pre-inner product, and we have to check a couple of things. Homogeneous degree 2 for the square of the norm, that's normal. Does it behave? What else do you have to check with an inner product? If it's 0, you want to be sure you're on the zero solution. So if this is 0, then that forces this. This estimate says that the symmetric hyperbolic estimate forces this also to be 0, which we know is equivalent to the LU2 norm, so it forces V to be 0. So it's a norm. So it's a pre-norm. Checking everything in your head. It's a pre-norm. It can make a norm. So that's my proposition 4 point. That's my next proposition. And that is the E star, and we've just checked it. The E star inner product defines a, so to speak, a norm, but so to speak, pre-norm on, and what do we have for V? Well, we have to start with V equals 0 at time capital T and move backwards. So on C1T of the slab. Okay, and the only thing we really had to check was non-degeneracy, and that's the symmetric hyperbolic estimate. So, now we wave our hands. Functional analysis, take the completion. Take this norm, E star, completion of C1 at T of RT. And it's a Hilbert space. So bar means completion, that's a Hilbert space, H. A Hilbert space. So definition 4.33, what am I going to find? What kind of solution am I going to find? I'm actually going to find a weak solution. We could work a little harder, but the time is getting later to make sure that it's strong in cases where we start with enough derivatives. I'm just going to show that there's a weak solution. So the definition is over a weak, what a weak solution means. A weak energy method solution, so a weak solution of our equation, I think equation 3 was our linear symmetric hyperbolic system, is a function U in L2 of the slab such that for basically all V in H, in particular all V in C1T, because C1T definitely is in H. This contains, that is H, but this of course it contains C1T. We have the following thing: integral from 0 to T, integral over Rn of V H dx dt is equal to integral from 0 to T, integral over Rn L star V U dx dt. And now, what's pretty much an obvious proposition 4.34, but I think I should say it, which is, if a weak solution U satisfies this, so if U actually happens to be in C10 of the slab, then that means if it's a classical solution of the problem, then star holds, where star is this. So the proposition says this is pretty reasonable to say, pretty reasonable condition to be a weak solution. That's what I want to say. And I guess I did the boundary conditions over here. Certainly, the integrations by parts in X and the integrations by parts in T give us the right terms in over the domain R of T, and the only boundary we have to worry about is the top and bottom boundaries. And those are taken care of by V being in C1T on the top and U being in C10 on the bottom. So at least we're looking in the right place for a solution. So let's do step 5. Now let's, given data, so given H in L2 of RT, we have to remember that over here we started mentioning Riesz representation theory. So what I'm going to do is take data H and define a linear functional. Define a linear functional. On Hilbert space H by the following expression. L of V, I want to be the inner product of V with H in the E inner product, but actually I'm just going to add an A0 inverse because I have to adjust it a little bit to be nice. Otherwise, I would have said, given data, I'm going to find, otherwise I would adjust my data. Let me adjust it like this. Now, now note that this is an E norm, but H is with the E star norm. It's a different norm. So just make sure you notice E star norm defines the space H, not the E norm. Okay? And then, so it's not completely clear. So it's pretty clear that L of V is bounded in linear functional on E, on L2. It's just an inner product with some annoying coefficients. But I want to show that it's a linear functional on H. So that's the lemma. 4.35, which goes as follows. Well, it simply says V functional L is bounded on H. Proof is basically, the proof is basically Cauchy-Schwarz and the symmetric hyperbolic systems estimate. Well, how big can LV be? Well, remember that LV is V, A0 inverse H, in E norm, which I can write as an integral. Maybe it's easier to just say bound it from above by some constant times V times H, and that's probably C0 times V in E times H in L2 of the slab. But V in E is bounded above by V and E star, by the symmetric hyperbolic estimate. So it's bounded above by C0 H in L2 V and E star by the symmetric hyperbolic estimate. And maybe this is now a new constant. C4, probably C5 just to make sure. And now L of V is bounded by some constant times V and E star. So that's the proof. What does Riesz say about bounded linear functionals? That there exist elements of the Hilbert space which represent them. So there exists, and Riesz says there exists a W. So Riesz implies, Riesz's theorem implies that there exists a W in our Hilbert space such that the following thing happens, that L of V is always equal to V, W, and E star. For all V and H. But V, W, and E star is a V, but LV we define to be V, A naught inverse, H in E. And if I rewrite V, W, and E star, that says that this is equal to, L star V, L star W in E. So thus for all E, so let me just rewrite this. That is, for all V and H, we have the following thing. The integral over T, integral over R, Rn, of VH dx dt. Because V, A naught inverse H, A naught inverse cancels the A in the E, so it's VH dx dt is equal to. So I just wrote the left hand side, now I'm going to write the right hand side. Is equal to the integral over T, integral over Rm, of what is it? L star V. And then L star, L star W dx dt. And so out of all this, what is U, the solution? So that is, the solution is U of xt is equal to whatever comes out here. That's what we need. So it's A naught L star of W. And this is an L2 function. And it's a weak solution. So the statement then of the theorem, the existence theorem, is I'll just put it in this last square of the blackboard. Theorem 4.36 is for all H in L2 of the slab, there exists a weak solution U to our equation 3 with appropriate data. And just a reminder that, in fact, we can and we will do higher Sobolev estimates on solutions to show that actually we get smooth solutions to the problem given smooth data. And we're going to use this and the higher Sobolev estimates when we solve the nonlinear problem. So let me stop here. Yes?
Why is U in L2?
W is in E star. So E star consists of those things where L star of a function is an L2. So L star of it's an L2. Otherwise, you might be taking derivatives of L2 functions and have to descend into something horrific like H minus 1. But in fact, you're sitting in L2. Okay, thank you for your patience. See you next week, but we'll meet in the library.